The farthest back that I can remember was probably about 2-3 years old, where I remember my father kicking in doors and putting hands on my mom and just beating her. I remember the cops coming over and the cops knowing us by name, bringing us toys, try to cheer us up. It was like a normal thing for them to come out. As my mom tried to leave that abusive relationship, she would go from one bad relationship to another, and it did introduce us to the drug life. I remember being 3-4 years old and sitting at the kitchen table with men just weighing out heroin, like it's like if they were weighing out wheat or something, you know. I remember our houses being raided and us having to run to our neighbor's house so, you know, we wouldn't get taken. Of course, I didn't know why we were running. I just knew we were going somewhere, you know. I was just confused. I wouldn't know what was going on. I didn't even think anything was wrong. I figured, okay, that's life, you know, as any other kid would. I didn't put two and two together until I was about 9 years old, when my mother would send me upstairs to the apartments that we would stay at with an envelope. And my mother's boyfriend at the time was a manager, so I thought, hey, you know, I'm just collecting rent for her, because that's what she would tell me. And little did I know that she was sending me on drug deals, and I didn't even know. I was just 9 years old, 8-9 years old. Until one day my friend and I were curious. My mother ended up leaving, and my friend and I were curious. I wonder what's in this envelope, and I said, let's open it. So when we opened it, it's when I seen a bag of methamphetamines, and I just felt a whole bunch of different rushes and memories and visions in my head, just, you know, of everything else that I've experienced. And that's when I realized, you know, the kind of life that we've been living. And because I always thought, you know, hey, we live a pretty nice life, you know, we're doing pretty good. But, you know, it was, to me, it seemed like it's just been one big lie. After that, I just ran with it. There was no turning back after that. You know, I that's the kind of life we were living. So I figured, hey, that's going to be me. I was already selling drugs by the time I was in sixth grade. I was already a full-blown pothead, going to school high, having weed in my pockets. I was a very sad child. I was very sad. I was very mad. I was very lost. I ended up becoming a cutter. I would cut my arms. I would burn my arms with the joints that I would smoke or cigarettes. Pain was something that I felt was my getaway to the pain that I already felt, or, you know, just escaping from what was already inside, you know, that darkness, the emptiness. And it had a lot to do with the anger that I felt inside because of, you know, the lifestyle that was just around me. You know, my mother exposing us to that, and I'm thinking that she's the one that's supposed to take care of us, but yet she got us in the mix of everything, you know. Anger towards the world because of the things that were said by the people that I thought were supposed to care about you. You know, my mom, you're going to be just like your dad, or you're going to be just like your brother, or my brother calling me a punk, or, you know, saying that you know, I'm not good enough or whatever. And the teachers as well, you know, all this negativity that we hear, saying that we're going to amount to nothing, that I'm just going to be in prison or dead or in jail, or, you know, I'm not going to make it. So I figured, hey, if I'm not going to make it, I might as well make something out of it now. And I think that if somebody would have took action, you know, if paid attention to the red flags, you know, it would have been a whole different story.
Welcome to Unhooked. My name is Pastor Bernie. Today we're talking about drug-endangered children. We have Dr. Kitty with us. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Who are drug-endangered children? Talk to us about that.
Drug-endangered children are children who are growing up in homes where parents or caregivers are abusing substances or manufacturing or cultivating them or selling them, which puts children at risk because the caretaking ability has been impaired.
Wow. So it sounds like these children are really in danger. And how's that impacting them? What's going on with these kids as they grow up in these environments?
Many times children in these environments, you have to understand, with substance abuse, they're very chaotic environments. And so there's no routine, there's no scheduling, there's perhaps a neglectfulness that's happening for the nurturing. And so the children are then not getting the proper developmental experiences in order to make the right gains. So they have a lot of risk factors. And when we have disruptions in our normal experiences, particularly early on in life, it can really affect us through all areas of our development.
Sure. So what's happening to these children as they are sort of set off on their course, their trajectory of life? What's happening to them later on in life?
Well, they have different things that will impact them later. So early on in life, if they didn't get the nurturing, that can affect them later. We see a lot of them have attachment disorders. That plays out as a later issue in their lives. We see many of them who have what we call post-traumatic stress disorder, in fact, where the home has been chaotic and they've had to be hypervigilant and so forth. So there's a lot of emotional behavioral things going on. Some of them also run into some physical concerns because they haven't gotten nutrition, or they, you know, especially if you're cultivating or manufacturing a substance, they may have ingested something that creates a toxin. And then, you know, they have also, not so many of them have cognitive issues like their IQ or their intelligence, but more areas that might impact them in school.
Sure. What about prenatally? What's happening? How are they being impacted that way?
In fact, I see prenatal exposure as also a drug-endangered child because they've had a toxin exposed to them while they've been in utero. Some of the things that we see, you know, the medical complications happen fairly early on, but later in life, more of what we're seeing is what we're calling many times we call it attention, but it isn't really that. It's their ability to organize and have the right state. So, for example, in this environment, we'd be calm and alert. And in another environment, you might be more drowsy or more. And they can't regulate their state or their emotions very well, making it difficult, particularly in the academic world.
Is there a chance that these children sometimes are treated differently in their schools and so forth as a result of kind of they're acting out what's going on with them, and it's sort of unfair in some ways? Yeah,
it is. And I think part of it is that we don't understand that they have had trauma, and that they most of us don't understand the combination of trauma and drug exposure, and so they get mislabeled. Many of them are called attention deficit and put on medication, or they're called bipolar, or a number of things, as opposed to really understanding the issues of attachment and trauma, et cetera. Now, some of them may need those kind of other helps that we see, but many times in the school system, it's played out differently, which is why I think we're seeing so many children having problems in preschool.
Wow. So I know this is so close to your heart. This, you know, you're so so involved in this work, and it means so much to you. Can you talk to us a little bit about maybe a story, something that you've experienced recently with a child that's grown up in one of these environments?
You know, so many come to mind, but I could tell you maybe about Sarah. And Sarah's 5 years old. Most of the children that I'm seeing don't have caregivers that are available to them because of their substance use, and often they're in the child protection system. Not always, but frequently. And Sarah was 5 and removed from her home. And she was the parent or the caregiver to her 3-year-old and 18-month-old sibling. And she was placed in foster care. And we try to place kids together because they've had so many other traumas. And, you know, she was having the most problem in that particular environment. And the idea was, oh, boy, we've got to move Sarah around. Well, really what it was is her role, the only thing she knew, the caregivers were like, she's not 5, she's not acting like 5. And the thing was, she's never been 5. She's been a parent at 5. And so instead of just seeing her as a problem, is trying to help her realize who is a 5-year-old child, that she is allowed to play, and that somebody else could be a parent. But those things take time, and we sometimes don't, we miss that.
Sure.
We misunderstand. But many of the children I see have really seen a lot of trauma. They've seen a lot of violence, or have been neglected or physically abused. We know that in the United States, in the child protection system, about 85% of the children in the system have been in homes where substances are a problem.
Oh, wow. It seems so incredibly tragic, of course, too, as you hear some of these stories. Talk to me a little bit about resiliency. I've heard that a lot, you know, that children are incredibly resilient. Talk a little bit about that.
Resiliency is not taking away all the stressors, but being able to face stressors and still maintain competent functioning. there's a lot of literature, a lot of work being done on resiliency, and we know that one of the key variables in resiliency is relationship. Okay. And if we're going to do something to help the resiliency of a child who has all of these risk factors, maybe emotional or behavioral or you know, some kind of learning problem or whatever, we have to put a very supportive, nurturing environment around them with that a relationship with an adult that can be valued and trusted.
Yeah, so things, mentoring programs, places where adults can be involved with kids, positive role models, all those sorts of things really contribute to helping kids bounce back from some of these things.
Absolutely, very crucial to their development and their ability to then get off that negative trajectory.
That's great. So that's what we want to have happen, is to get off of that negative trajectory. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
As a young adult, when my wife and I got together, we met in a drug deal. You know, she came over to my house and with a friend of mine. They just came to pick up and score, and they introduced her to me, and we got along pretty well. She kept coming over, and you know, little before we knew it, we were together. When I told my mother that my girlfriend was pregnant, she ended up kicking us out, and my father-in-law told me that, you know, if I wanted to get myself out of this situation, the main thing I had to do was, you know, get my butt to work, except that he didn't put it so nicely, you know. I felt really low, you know, and even though I felt really low, we were still hitting the pipe. We were still, you know, in our addiction, mimicking basically what I was experienced and exposed to as a child. If not even worse, though, because, you know, we were homeless. A week before my daughter was born, we were actually able to save enough money to get our own apartment. And we thought, hey, you know, we're making it. But of course, you know, the devil's a liar. You know, as much as I was trying to work as hard as I could to get where we were at, because we went from living in a tent, being homeless, to living in a garage, to taking care of somebody's property, to, you know, our one-bedroom apartment, you know, and I'm thinking, hey, we're doing such a great job, you know, but yet, you know, I still allowed the addiction to take over and to run our lives. We got so far in our addiction where, you know, everything just finally hit the fan. My wife was pregnant with our second child, and still in our addiction. She ended up going to labor while I was at work, and she was crying because, you know, we both knew she was dirty. I'm panicking inside. I'm trying to hold my composure, but I'm panicking because I don't want my kids taken. I worked so hard to see my family just get taken from me. And it happened. And that's really the turning point, because that's when my family was separated. My wife had to go into program. My two daughters were separated, and one was in foster care and the other one was with my sister-in-law. And it was a struggle because we're addicts, so those desires are there. The fight inside our minds are there. But I knew that there's no turning back at this point. It's do or die. It's either you do it or you lose your family. It's either the bright light or, you know, eternal darkness. And I refuse to live in that darkness. I refuse to go back to my old ways, because the vision that I had in my mind was of my family reunited and living happily.
Welcome back to Unhooked. We're talking about drug-endangered children. So, Dr. Kitty, in our story, Juan grew up and became a drug user. What role did his environment play in that?
It's a key role. In fact, we know that children who grow up in homes where substances are a problem are four times more likely to they themselves becoming addicts. And so this is part of that long-term trajectory that we're worried about, is that when you're young, these are role-modeled ways. These are ways that your environment has shown you how to cope with problems. It reminds me of a young lady, Angela, whom I met actually met her because we were running a program for overweight children. She was 15, she weighed probably about 250 pounds, and she'd come in and she started crying when she was talking to our pediatrician because she said, you know, I haven't told anyone yet that I'm pregnant and I don't know if I can do these exercises. So we come to find out, she said, as many of them do, I love my mom, but, and she did her drug treatment, but now we're back in her home and I'm pregnant from her boyfriend. And so her coping mechanism was to use meth. So the hard part for me was knowing I had to send her over to the hospital for her pregnancy work, but she wouldn't be the victim. Now she's going to be a pregnant substance using woman, and she's 15. And so these are the kinds of things I think that as a community we need to be aware of.
For sure. And it seems like it's not like these things are happening way later in life. They're happening as these kids are really, really young. I mean, it's not like they're, you know, adults and all of a sudden these issues pop up, but they're just falling right.
You know, there are so many different things that might happen in childhood that have immediate effects, but those effects do impact us later. There was a study, in fact, that really validates this that was called the ACE study, or Adverse Childhood Experiences. And just really briefly to summarize it, they asked adults 10 questions about abuse and neglect and their home environment. And from those 10 questions, what they realized is the more adverse experiences we have as a child, the more likely we are to have diseases in adulthood and early death, because the trajectory goes from negative experience, disrupted development that we've been talking about, into high-risk behaviors, then disease and early death. And so really our goal is we have to get the young off of this trajectory.
Yeah, it has to happen really fast. You know, what role can a church play in helping kids, helping to break some of these trajectories and change trajectories?
I mentioned it briefly in the previous segment, but to get off that trajectory, what we really do know is that we have to provide an improved social environment. Mm. In terms of the church, I can't think of a better place where we can offer an improved social environment. That's what we need to be to our community, is that improved social environment.
Absolutely.
We know that even a heritable vulnerability can be an asset if we improve the environment in which that person is in. So the church can offer activity to young people. I mean, when are they getting in trouble? When are these risk behaviors occurring? When they don't have things to do, when there's no adult supervision.
Sure.
So that becomes important.
Churches are a great place. I mean, you have lots of adults around.
Yes.
And perhaps a good, strong, you know, adult that can be somewhat of a role model that can engage in their life would be another way that you can sort of change their social environment.
Well, and the key part that you put in there is the other adults.
Yeah.
We were created as relational beings.
Amen.
And it's our relationship to God, because we all have risk factors. We all have things that, you know, can affect our trajectories as well. What can keep us and help us on a positive pathway is our relationship to God. And it's modeled through those around us. And we need to be that for those children in our community. You know, often I've heard people say, well, you know, I just thought, oh, those child, you know, they're running around the neighborhood. Where, how about bringing them in and stop letting them run around and feed them dinner?
Yeah, you know, Charles Barkley famously said that he's not a role model. Well, as Christians, you don't get to say that. You are. Every adult that walks in that church and claims to be a Christian is, in fact, a role model. They're modeling something for all those children that show up at that church. So I think that's so important. I know, again, you just have such a heart for what you do. Where is hope at for you? Where do you see glimpses of hope? How do you stay positive about all that you do?
You know, I see many children who've been harmed in those ways. I think the way that I see hope is in a couple of different ways. One is, how do I make today better? There's a saying I have, what you think of me, I will think of me. And what I think of me, I will become. And I try to let that child know. Sometimes I'm the first person who said to that child, I'm so glad I got to meet you and got to know you today. They've never had anyone say that. So in that way, I feel like, what can I do in the moment? But then who can I be, and how can I impassion others to be that for these children? So I believe because of God and Christ that we all have hope, And it is never too early and never too late, and we must never give up. We are all agents of change.
Absolutely. Amen. I love that. And, you know, I think about, you know, this whole subject and how important and how precious children are. What can adults, children can often be quite frightening to adults. What is a simple thing or some simple ways that adults can engage in the lives of children in a positive way?
Yeah, I know. Sometimes it's amazing to me how frightened they are.
Yeah.
So one of the things I've learned the best is to just make it a little task, you know, not to say you're going to be the mentor or you're going to be the So just say, can you help them with their homework? Could you teach them how to take a car apart or change a tire? You know, this is where churches could get involved too. You know, all those different skill sets. Just have a simple task. And all it is about helping on one thing and learning their name. And guess what? After a period of time, a relationship develops and it's not scary anymore. So even if there's one thing, oh, all I can do for this child is maybe have them over for dinner, or, you know, I could offer to teach them something or help them with homework or whatever your skill set is, kids want your attention. They just love it.
Even just working with my own kids, I've learned that if I involve them, our relationship becomes so much more. You know, sometimes if I'm out in the garage doing something, can I help with that, Daddy? And I, you know, I'm like, no, I really don't have time for that. But if I involve them, there's a deeper bond there. There's a better relationship that emerges. Dr. Kitty, you've been awesome. Thank you so much for being a part of it. And Unhooked, we'll be right back.
People that knew me and my addiction, they told me that as I was growing up, I would always say things, and I don't remember these things, so this is cool right here. I don't remember saying these things, but they said that I would always say that I'm gonna be the changer, the cycle breaker. Not in those words, but I was always gonna make something out of my life, that I was gonna get myself out of, you know, I was gonna leave and do something with my life, that I was gonna change, that when I had kids, you know, I'm gonna make sure that my kids don't go through what I had to go through. And I didn't even know I thought like that. I didn't know that it was possible, but change is possible. I know now that the reason why I went through what I went through was that powerful testimony that I walk with. I'm going on 7 years clean. And I know that if it wasn't for the grace of God, I wouldn't even be here today. By the grace of God, I have been renewed. My mind's been renewed and restored. My heart is now just full of love rather than full of anger and resentment. And it's because the love that God has for us, you know, He's been able to restore not just me, but my family. I don't take that lightly. You know, I try to work for God diligently and just seek Him in all I do. And I try to show my kids that that's what life is all about. It's not about being perfect. It's about fighting a good fight. And in fights, you lose rounds. You know, there's not such thing as just a one round fight. You know, there's many rounds in a fight. But as long as you keep fighting, just like in races, it's not just one race and you're the best racer in the world. You know, there's many races that you're gonna have to race. You know, so as long as we keep racing, as long as we keep fighting, you know, we're gonna come out on top. Because God's going to be pleased with what you've done, with what He's given you. You know, in the book of Philippians, it talks about His work is like ongoing. You know, and it's so awesome because I see it to this day that no matter what I struggle in, I go to Him to it, and He just comforts me and lets me know that it's all going to be okay. And that's what He did from the beginning. From the beginning, my kids were taken, and everything just seemed like it was just in an uproar and that I wasn't gonna make it once again. And when I went to God with it, and he gave me a vision of my children and my wife back together. And it came true. He gave me a vision of my wife and family living a sober and clean life of just nothing but just smiles on our faces. And it's true. There's not one day that goes by without us as a family just laughing together. And every time I see it, I sit back and I thank God, because I know it's His love. I know it was His plan the whole time. And it doesn't stop there. God is working all the time. He was the same yesterday, he's the same today, and he'll be the same tomorrow.
Hello, friends. We've just learned from Dr. Kitty about the devastation that children who are raised in homes where there's addiction face. There are so many things that they struggle with because that's what they've learned in this negative environment. Juan told us about his negative environment, the pain and the loss he suffered, and how he struggled through addiction and lost his own family in the process, but how he's regained it through Jesus. Many times, these children learn that they have to take on a role in order to survive in the family. Some of those roles are the family hero, where I have to be successful to make my family successful. Some of them are scapegoated, where all the problems of the family are put on them. Others are mascots, where they have to be funny in order to make the family less tense and stressful. But you can have victory from these things. You can be free. For more information on how you can break free from any of these habits that hurt in families, contact Adventist Recovery Ministries. And for prayer, call 1-888-446-7388. Choose to become unhooked today.